This is Trending Now on MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh Arnold. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky. And as we end the month of March, we got a snowstorm scheduled. And what do you got lined up for today?
Well, today we have Joanne Simons, the executive director of Northeast ARC, will be our first guest. Second guest is Megan Gormley, who's the volunteer service manager for the U.S. Seniors Open, which will be in Peabody this end of June into July. And then City Council President Joseph Chilino will be our third guest today.
Gloucester City Council. All right. Okay, all of that and more coming right up.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sauk Asian Sportswear handles all aspects of your need, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SaukAsianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place to go.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is the executive director of Northeast ARC, Joanne Simons. Joanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Well, my wife was looking at my list of guests a couple of weeks ago and said, "Oh, you have Joanne Simon," and I said, "Yes," and she said, "I didn't know you'd always." Well, she's going to be on the show, so anyway,
happy to have her part of our family here.
Great. Usually start out, tell us a little bit about your background. I've read your bio and everything, but introduce yourself to the listening audience, background and education.
Sure,
and
happy
and
to
so
do
forth.
That. Right. So, but you don't have a few hours, so I'm going to have to give you the elevator speech here. You know, I am passionate about the work that we do, discovering the abilities of people, and that really comes from a very personal place. Almost 37 years ago, actually, now almost 38 years ago, my first child was born with Down syndrome and four heart defects, and I had a master's degree in social work and, you know, was charging around thinking that I was going to be able to change the world. And then I was presented with an opportunity to actually impact something very important to me, which was my son. And I realized that the system that I thought that should be in place to support families didn't exist. There was nobody that came to my hospital room to talk to me. There was nobody that was making direct referrals to early intervention programs. There weren't parent support groups. I was basically left alone to navigate a system that I had believed existed. And I realized if it didn't exist for me, and here I was, you know, savvy as a, you know, social worker and having just received a master's degree, surely other families were feeling the same way. So I, in the early days of his life, realized that in order to save my life and also save his life, I wanted to really have a career here. And that led me, ironically, after my first job was actually with the state, but shortly thereafter in the early 80s, led me to what has become the Northeast ARC. At that time, it was the North Shore ARC. And I was the director of advocacy, the first director of advocacy, the first person to, dedicated to supporting families. It was a shop of one. Mm. And in the 8 years that I was there, establishing the first family support program in the state and perhaps in the country, we became and have established ourselves ever since as the organization that supports families from cradle to end of life. And after 8 years there, I had a series of positions in state government, and then I spent 15 years as the executive director of the of EMARC, an organization similar to the Northeast ARC. And most recently, I spent the last 7.5 years before coming here as the CEO of the Cardinal Cushing Centers. And then a couple of years ago, you know, people approached me about the opportunity to become the CEO at the Northeast ARC to succeed Jerry McCarthy, who had been here for 36 years, who had led this organization through incredible growth and increasing significance for the work that he was able to do. And it was just an opportunity that I couldn't turn down to kind of come full circle now. I'm back as the CEO leading an organization that has 1,000 employees and over 40 locations and a large operating budget, and we're doing, you know, transformational work.
Great.
All because of an extra chromosome that my son received.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you did, you've done great work. Tell us, what does the Northeast ARC do?
We support families and individuals who are facing disability, although we like to call that we're discovering abilities rather than the emphasis on the disability. We can support a family prenatally, even before they've had the child, if they happen to have a prenatal diagnosis. And we also support that family if they find out later in the early years of their child's life that they might have a disability, as in the case of autism. So we have a huge autism support center. We've been providing autism services for 25 years before it became, you know, well known.
Sure.
And at that point, 25 years ago, families were facing this diagnosis often in isolation without the kind of support that we made available to them. So we can provide to an infant intensive in-home supports for their child so that we can make sure that the outcome for that child is as positive as possible. And we then continue to provide services to families through our recreation program, through our intensive autism programs, through family support programs, through lots of educational opportunities for families, advocacy programs. We provide, you know, I really want to emphasize our recreation program, which now, with a wonderful partnership with Special Olympics, we're providing not only traditional Special Olympic sports like powerlifting, but unified tennis and traditional basketball and soccer and hopefully flag football and just an array of sports that will be available, as well as just typical kind of recreation programs that young people, teens, and adults appreciate. One specific program that I want your listeners to know about is that we have a spotlight program for young people and teens and young adults with autism. That's a drama-based program, and it's really an acclaimed, you know, nationally recognized intervention for those folks on the autism spectrum. And for, you know, families and individuals with autism out there that may be listening, you know, we also provide services to folks with autism who do not have an intellectual disability. And that's really important for people to understand, is that not everybody with autism also has an intellectual disability. You know, we know there are incredibly famous, well-accomplished people throughout the world who have high-functioning autism or Asperger's, and we support those folks as well. And then our more traditional services, like residential services, where we support people either in group homes or in something called Shared Living, which is a very exciting program if people are interested, where we will place a person with a disability in someone's home, and that person receives a generous tax-free stipend for making that individual part of their home. And then we have employment programs. And our signature program that people don't know about is that we opened a couple months ago a coffee shop on Main Street in Peabody called Breaking Grounds. It's a coffee shop where we change lives one cup at a time, and Governor Baker stopped by and had a great cup of coffee and a wonderful cookie, and I encourage everybody to do the same.
Great.
Live music every Friday.
Now, in terms of advocacy, I'm also an advocate for children with special needs, and I represent parents and go into the schools and stuff. Is that a piece of what you folks do as well?
Yes, we do that as well, and that was actually something that we started back in the 80s when I was there, you know. And last night we just heard from a parent that no matter how sophisticated and informed a parent is. The work that you do, Josh, and the work that we do is really critically important, because advocating for your own child can sometimes be emotionally very difficult. But having an independent auditor there who has your back and is willing to be able to say to the school district, this is what we want. This is what this child needs, and here's the information to back that up. So what you do and we do it is very, very important.
Well, I had a couple of interesting. The first time I advocated, I was still in educational administration. I was an assistant superintendent of operations in New Hampshire, and I went down to the two-way school district. I won't mention it, where my nephew lived, and Asperger's and ADHD, OCD, and so forth, and he was getting gym, lunch, reading, and he was home by 11. As he went to the sixth, as he merged into the sixth grade.
You know, you don't know whether or not to laugh or cry when you hear something like that.
It was a more affluent community, and I said to my sister and brother-in-law going in, I said, "All right, I'm going to be the gorilla. They're not going to like me. Don't worry about it. You know, this part of the take." So they go around the room in the traditional setting, and da-da-da-da-da. Everybody says what a nice boy John is. And I said, at the end of the thing, I said, "Look, we're all in agreement. John's a great kid. But in the final analysis, at the end of the day, what is he getting for an education?" You know, I said, "Do you?" I said, and that, at the time, they were still operating under the old guidelines of Chapter 766. I said, "You folks don't even cover." Of course, it's IDEA 2004 now, but at the time, it was 94-142 federal legislation. I said, "You guys don't even cover that." You know, and on. A week later, he was in another district placement, and it all worked. And but it's.
It worked because you were a gorilla.
Yeah, because I was a gorilla, and my brother-in-law said, "I felt like you had a gun under the table." I said, "No, the gun was on the table." They all knew it. And I said, "Well, if you can see the SPED director's jaw drop when I said I was an assistant superintendent of schools in New Hampshire, like, oh, they brought a ringer." Anyway, tell me, what's new at Northeast ARC?
Well, I think I closed a little bit by telling you that the coffee shop is really very exciting. We opened that coffee shop with the idea that we were going to train people with disabilities who have expressed an interest in working in food services but hadn't had the opportunity to develop the skills. And we've already placed two people in jobs from that opportunity that we've been able to provide, in a place where customers are friendly and there's not as much pressure as they may be in another location or another food service operation. We've been welcomed and supported by the community. Mayor Betancourt has just been spectacular, and we are hoping that we're going to be doing more of these kinds of entrepreneurial things, supporting communities and defining what communities need. The city of Peabody, has expressed a need to have a coffee shop and a black box theater. And who would have thought that the Northeast ARC was going to be the organization that is going to be able to provide both of those things to the city of Peabody.
That's great.
We already opened the coffee shop, and we're raising the money now for the Black Box Theater, which will be in our art center, which is around the corner on Foster Street. We already have an art center, but in the back we had a former warehouse, perfect space for a Black Box Theater.
Great.
Those are two things that are happening, but we're also, wanting to provide more localized services and more recreation opportunities in various communities throughout the our service area, which really runs from, up to your...
What's the future for Northeast ARC and for the people with disabilities? Can you give us...
Right now we're all holding our collective breath because, any assault on Medicaid will certainly affect us. 75% of our budget comes from Medicaid, so the conversations in Washington are ones that we're watching very, very closely, and I don't think that people realize that when they think of Medicaid, they think of people abusing the healthcare system, the traditional healthcare system, but what they don't realize is that people with disabilities and their families depend on Medicaid for almost 100% of the critical services that they receive. So that's a bit of concern to us. We'll continue to try to educate and inform our families and our and continue to thank our delegation for the work that they're doing to preserve those that safety net for people, because our folks depend on Social Security and Medicaid, both of which, you know, right now seem to be popular discourse. But I am hopeful that by educating the American people, they will understand that they really need to support and empower this group of very important group of people. I see more incredible programs. We have a great partnership with Salem State University in a program called Project Search, where we're training young people that are transitioning out of high school for the next steps in their lives, and we're able to do it on a college campus. You know, this is something that people might not have even imagined possible. We're going to see more people with disabilities going to college. We're going to see more of them being part of, I think, you know, I kind of think of the world now as made up of disruptors, you know, like, you know, ride-hailing services. And I think that those, all these changes that are happening in the larger community have great, that we need to pay attention to, because they can impact positively the work that we do. Technology is an area that's going to, I think, continue to open up new and bigger and better frontiers for people with disabilities. So those are a few of the things that, that I see happening in a broad sense. And for us at the Northeast ARC, we're going to continue to listen to families and listen to the individuals that we support, and provide them with, you know, person-centered very services that meet their needs.
What you mentioned, the coffee shop and the Black Box Theater. What are some of the other? To what extent are you mapping plans to do that in other communities, and what would that process include?
Well, I think we look to see that the future will be that partnering with communities to identify what they need, and is there a way that we can make our mission meet that community needs, rather than us thinking that the communities have a responsibility to meet our needs, that we really see ourselves part of downtowns and part of community centers, mm-hmm. in ways that can have multiple purposes. So we'll be looking to do more partnerships with, you know, organizations and with municipalities to make better communities for everybody. Because, if the community is a good place for a person with a disability to live, chances are it's a great place for anybody to live.
It's the communities that would be in the geography that you serve. What is that? How many communities are?
You know, we serve. Our core area is Gloucester, Burlington, Lynn, that triangle.
Okay.
But we have a larger service area for some of our programs, which actually go from the New Hampshire border, 495, down to the South Shore. And those services are our programs that are, one is a program called Building Blocks, which is a program for kids birth to three who have autism. And then that program extends an ABA specialty program for kids up to 22. That's a broader service area. So is our personal care attendant program, which provides opportunities for people who need personal care. And it may be somebody who has, you know, MS or ALS or, you know, a cognitive disability who needs, you know, actual hands-on kinds of support in the home. That has a much larger geographic border, you know, as do our adult family care and other programs. I really encourage people to go onto our website, check out the Northeast ARC, because it's almost impossible in a short period of time, sure. to tell you all that we do. I mean, we touch 8,000 people a year in terms of providing services to them.
Great.
And that's, we have quite a broad impact. And, you know, to do that, you know, not only do we depend on Medicaid dollars and state dollars, of which we're very grateful, but we also have to fundraise, and we have to ask people to support the services that they think are important to continue in their community. We have a gala coming up on April 29th, which is going to be at the Danvers Port, and we are...
Hello?
...with celebrities in the community, and we have some TV and radio personalities and state government officials and local CEOs, and it will be a great night, and I hope that either your listeners might be interested in attending, or if they have any great auction items, would love to have them give us a call and be part of what I think is a spectacular organization.
Well, that's great, and I appreciate you shared that with us. I noticed in the context of the geography that you serve also lines up pretty well with what's Rotary District 7930. So if you're not into the Rotary Clubs, chatting with those folks, that may be something you want to consider going forward.
Thank you, and we actually have our one of our senior development officer actually is a Rotarian.
Okay.
So we are certainly aware, and no one can argue with the amazing work that the Rotary does, and really so many civic organizations in our region, and we want to partner with all of them. And
great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and wish you the very best in your future endeavors.
Thanks, Josh. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
MSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders. Mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Megan Gormley, who is the Volunteer Service Manager for the U.S. Seniors Open, which is coming up in June and July. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll usually start out and just ask folks to tell us a little bit about their background, your bio, and then maybe we can get into some questions about the work you're doing with the Seniors Open.
Yeah, no problem. I am actually originally from California. I relocated to Massachusetts earlier this year for this particular role. It's about my third USGA championship working on volunteers. So I actually was a special events major in college, and so I've always been a big sports fan and a sports lover and actively involved in sports, and so this kind of seemed like the perfect fit for me.
Great. And the U.S. Senior Open is going to be held where and when coming up?
It is going to be held June 26th to July 2nd at Salem Country Club in Peabody, Mass. The 26th, 27th, and 8th are practice rounds, and then championship play begins on that Thursday.
Great. And the United States Golf Association is a national governing body of golf for the U.S. and Mexico. What are some of the responsibilities that they're tagged with?
So the USGA is most responsible for playing out the 13 national championships, the U.S. Opens for women, men, and the seniors, obviously. They also write the rules of golf and conduct equipment testing, fund research for better turf and better environment, and they basically celebrate the history of the game of golf.
And some of the players you expect to compete during the tournament, can you name some for the audience?
Yeah, no problem. So we are expecting 156 professional and amateurs to be here in Peabody, Mass. We can expect, Olin Brown, Fred Couples, Tom Watson, Colin Montgomery, Davis Love III, so some pretty well-known names.
Great. And how many people will this type of tournament draw for viewing during the several days of the practice and then the tournament?
So right now we are anticipating between 120 and 140,000 people through the gates the duration of the week. So obviously a huge, huge event. Back when it was held at Salem Country Club in 2001, it was a complete sellout a year in advance. And again, we're expecting 156 professional and amateurs to compete.
Now, the work that you do involves recruiting volunteers. Tell us about that. I know, maybe start out with, how many volunteers does it take to run an operation like this? And what are some of the responsibilities and tasks that these folks are going to be engaging?
So for an event of this size, it really takes a lot of manpower. We are planning between 2,000 and 3,000 volunteers to help run the entire championship. They operate close to 30 different committees. We really have something for everyone. If you are a golf fan and really want to be involved in the action, we have some great scoring committees. If you aren't really a golf fan but still want to come out and experience it, we have committees like merchandise and product distribution and VIP player transportation. So between the 30 different committees and the 2,000 volunteers, it really is a large group that helps put this on, and we could not do that without their help.
And so what kinds of training would folks need, and how is that coordinated?
So a lot of the volunteer committees don't require any sort of prior training. A lot of training will just kind of happen during your first shift on site.
Okay.
We have a couple committees that do require a day or two prior to the championship beginning. One of them is our laser operators committee, which is relatively newer on the USGA side of things. Those individuals operate a manual laser ball tracking device, and they communicate the locations that are then shown to viewers on TV. So some of the tech-based committees require a little bit of training, but there's really no prior experience needed for the majority of them.
And you mentioned the media. How much of a media presence, and how many people around the world will experience this?
So we will be broadcasting in more than 100 countries. We'll have 16 hours of live television coverage Thursday through Sunday, the championship days, on Fox and Fox Sports 1. So we'll have close to 100 media partners on site the duration of the week.
Great. And can you run through a little bit more about the different tasks? You mentioned 30 committees. What are some of those things that people will be doing?
So a lot of our committees have already closed, but the ones that are still available for people to sign up if they are interested, access control and corporate hospitality, those people are stationed at more restricted areas throughout the championship. They would check credentials, check tickets, make sure people have proper access into those areas. Leaderboards, laser ops, marshaling. Leaderboards, they will post the player information on manual boards reported by the USGA. The merchandise committee, you work in our main merchandise pavilion that's located at the main entrance of the championship. It's more of a customer service-based committee, but you learn how to operate our POS system, work with some of our clothing vendors that are on site. Another one that I had touched on was the VIP transportation. So those individuals will receive inventory control, the Lexus courtesy cars that are given to all the players, and help drive shuttles for players and player family. Two other committees I want to highlight for those individuals that are listening that may be interested. We offer two junior volunteer positions. So we reserve those for kids ages 13 to 17. Junior positions are standard bearers and program sales. Program sales are responsible for selling the championship program on course. And then standard bearers are responsible for carrying the two-sided scoring standard, which is for posting player scores and keeping spectators updated on where each player stands. That's a really unique and special committee in the sense that it's only one of two championship committees allowed inside the ropes walking with a player.
Great. Now, of these 2,000 to 3,000 people who are volunteering, they're obviously not. They're all working different shifts. But you offer as a benefit for someone who volunteers certain benefits to participate or to watch or to be a spectator. What are some of those benefits that go that volunteers receive as part of this?
Yeah, so we ask that as a volunteer to the championship, you work four-hour shifts over the course of 7 days of the championship. There is a fee that is associated with volunteering. However, that fee covers the uniform costs that you get with your package, as well as a week-long ticket into the championship. So we encourage volunteers, when they're not working, to come back and view golf. Along with that, they'll also receive a championship water bottle, a piece of logoed headwear. All the food and beverage is provided on the days they're working on site. They'll have access to the volunteer hospitality area on course. There's soft seating in there, televisions, air conditioning, as well as free admission to the kickoff party. And that happens June 24th. It's the Saturday prior to the championship. And then we also just rolled out another opportunity for volunteers. It's an upgrade to the Francis We Met Trophy Club. So that is a upgraded hospitality area on course. It's just a nicer pavilion. It's on the 17th fairway, so it has great views of golf. And all volunteers have the option of upgrading to that.
Okay, what does that involve, the upgrading? That just costs a little bit more money? Or?
Yep, so right now, if you were to visit our website, all of our ticket pricing and options are on there. As I mentioned, all volunteers receive a week-long ticket into the championship. The week-long ticket to the Francis We Met Trophy Club is selling for $225 online by itself. So we are offering that week-long ticket to volunteers who are registered in our system at $50 for the week.
Oh, good. Great. And got a few more minutes left. Anything else that you want to share? If somebody wants to volunteer or just obtain tickets, where would they go to get that information?
Yeah, if you would like more information on the championship as a whole, go ahead and visit our website. It's 2017ussenioropen.com. It has all of our ticket information on there, event info for parking and where things on the course will be located. It has hospitality info if you're interested in that, as well as all of the volunteer info I talked about. You can register directly online to be a volunteer. The process takes about 5 minutes from start to finish. Or if you have more questions, you can always call our office and ask to speak with me directly, and I'm happy to answer any questions or get people registered to volunteer over the phone.
You know, you mentioned 120,000 to 140,000 people that will show up over the course of the tryouts and the trials and the tournament. Where do all those people park? I mean, I have to assume that there's a lot of off, course parking, and is there a shuttle service, and how does all that work?
So all parking for general spectators and volunteers is free. It's located at Topsfield Fairgrounds.
Okay.
And then volunteers and spectators will be shuttled to the main entrance of the championship and dropped off.
Okay. Very well.
One other thing I'd like to mention is we try to make the championship really family friendly. So all kids 17 and under get in free with a ticketed adult.
Wow, that's great. Well, it's very generous. And do a lot of families take advantage of that?
They do, and we try to make it really fun for kids to get involved. Tuesday and Wednesday of the practice days, those are highlighted as our junior day. So we will have a local celebrity. We just announced Ray Bourque as the honorary chairman to the Senior Open, and then we'll get a couple of the professional golfers, and we'll put on a junior clinic for all kids are welcome, any age, on the driving range.
Oh, great. And lost my question, but that's fine. So I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. wish you the very best of success in this endeavor. And again, sounds like quite an undertaking, and this must be very satisfying work for you.
It is, and I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Okay, Megan. Take care. Have a good day. Bye now.
You too. Bye.
Take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Hi, this is Saka Sarkisian, owner of Sarkisian Sportswear, located on Route 1 South in Peabody. We are a sports team dealer and custom apparel distributor that can handle all of your team's or company's uniform and apparel needs. So stop by and visit us at 182 Newbury Street in Peabody to see our storefront. Visit with our friendly and helpful staff and let us help you get the right fit for your program. Also, you can visit our website, SarkisianSports.com, to view our monthly specials and learn more about us.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 Series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Gloucester City Council President Joe Cellino. Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you once again for inviting me, Josh.
Well, you've... had a busy term so far as council president. We're probably 1.3, one and a quarter of the way through the term. What have been the challenges for you and as you look back over this term leading as its council president?
Coming into the presidency, during the last year, in January, we started, right after the election, too, is that there were brand new councillors. And then that's a big chunk of the council that had turned over. And getting them up to speed after I was elected, president of the council, has been the challenge, and has been a worthwhile challenge, because I am so proud of the five new councils and how they take it to it, and how they know the terminology and understand what the job entails, and how to go about to making change, whether they're at large or whether they're a ward. So that has been the challenge that I've had, and I've also did something a little bit different. Also, is that In the charter, the city council president is basically supposed to form the agenda and run the meeting. And so I've stuck to that. And what I mean by that is that I run the meeting, and I really don't say much concerning the subject at hand until the last. Everybody has spoken, and then I might say a few words of which way I'm going to vote. that's the way the charter, has been organized, and it's worked. It works very well. Gives an opportunity to the council to give their views, and not have the city council president either not recognize them or whatever, just to steer the conversation. So that has, and then I've also want to keep the city council, and I think I've done it this year, is that intact. I don't want any right that the city council has now to be taken away. And that is something that I got from former councilor Ab Kambadi. And we inherit the city council, and we don't give anything away, any of the powers to the city council. And when I say powers, I mean giving things away to the mayor's office. We're two distinct branches. The mayor's office is executive, and the city council is legislative, and we work together. The mayor proposes, and the city council disposes of whatever she proposes.
And it's a check and balance system.
And it works very well. And sometimes, there have been a few challenges this year, but I think this administration realizes that this council is not going to give up any of its rights that it's had in the past. Not a big deal, but I feel that once you start giving things away, it diminishes the power of the city council.
And you have that responsibility as the leader of the present group, but you also have to look at it, which is an interesting perspective, and I'm not sure how many of the listening audience would key in on this, but you also have that responsibility to protect the rights of future city councils based on what decisions or actions you take as its leader now.
Absolutely, and you always are, when you're going to have to the point where you're going to hand it over to somebody else, and you'll want that council to be just as strong as previous councils and not to weaken it. I think it's a job of the city council president to defend that, and as is the job of the mayor to defend the executive branch. But it works well, and we respect each other with the current administration, and the current administration respect us. Not that we agree on anything, not that we agree on everything. What we do agree is that sometimes there's a different option to get to where the solution to the problem is, and that's where you work with the administration to come up with the solutions that are going to be satisfactory for everybody concerned.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I like what they do in Washington, but, we work together. We're nonpartisan, so we work for the good of the community.
How often, from your vantage point, do people come in perhaps with a predisposition or a predetermined outlook on an issue, I'm talking about members of the council, and then in the course of debate, perhaps listening to the reports by the standing committees, change their viewpoint. Do you see that happen often, or does it happen at all? Or
well, what I instilled in especially the new councilors is that really not to make your mind until you hear whatever the public hearing is or whatever the issue is, because exactly when you're in the standing committee and let's say planning and development, and for what you hear is one thing and you vote for it, and then all of a sudden all the neighbors show up and tell you a different side of the story.
Yeah.
And which you didn't hear in the first place. So the planning board is basically a recommending body, but it doesn't mean that once you vote at planning that you're going to vote the same way. And that happens a lot.
Okay.
You hear just the person that is the proponent. You don't hear about the opposition, and that's what's good about having the council hearings and the public hearings, is to get people in there. And a lot of times I've changed my mind. Well, I didn't know any of this,
yeah.
And what the potentials are, and all the rest of it.
How do you? how do you deal with somebody who stands up and says, bing, bang, and bong? And it that's really not what happened, but it may be the way that person sees it. And it's not that they're deliberately attempting to distort the truth. It just may be that their perspective of it is different than what some other people's perspective of it is. How difficult is it to sort through some of those, and how often do you find yourself trying to weigh in, is this on the level, or is this just, you know, maybe has this person veered off the road a little bit, or?
Well, sometimes, you know, that comes with experience. And no, you were at City Council the last time, and there were some statements made and about the West Gloucester sewer district. Yeah. That was put in. And I was there. I was part of that council that put that all into place. And sometimes, you know, the attorney, he has to do what he has to do for his client to say what he has to say. And sometimes, you know, a couple of times during that meeting, I had to sit up in my chair because, you know, what he was saying was not true.
Yeah. And I saw that.
And so, you know, you have to make that clear. And we did. And we voted it down. So a lot, you know, and sometimes I get disappointed that people say, "Well, you know, you guys all make up your mind, you know, before you go into council." No, that's not true. You know, we're there to listen. And one of the things that has been the hallmark of my presidency at City Council, everybody gets an opportunity to speak. I never really shut anybody off, you know, unless they really become abusive. But everybody gets an opportunity to speak. And we had somebody the other day, we were talking about the Mayport Avenue School, and he said, I got to say that what I'm seeing here tonight was under oral communication, that we hear from the residents, that this is democracy the way it was designed to operate. He says, I'm very happy that this council has taken the time to listen to what our issues are and what our problems are. And that's what we do. In the training sessions of all the during the councils, we're there to listen. I tell my counselors all the time, we're there to listen, and whatever has to be said. But that's how we can make things happen, is if we find out, you know, what's going on with the people. And I'll tell you, it's invaluable that you just don't want to hear just from an attorney. For our proponent, you want to hear from the other side, and you want to give them the opportunity to say their piece, and that's what we do. But and that turns your turn your view of how you're going to vote on this thing.
Well, Socrates wrote, "Democracy at its best comes from a contrast of opinions," and it sounds like the way you run the meeting, you certainly flush that out, so everybody gets a chance to express their viewpoint.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I remember the book "Man of the House," Tip O'Neill wrote, and he spoke of his time before he was speaker, and then as speaker, how important it was that at the end of the day, they were all still friends, no matter how they voted on any given issue.
Yep.
And yet, that's not the way it works today in Washington. How does that play out on your shift in terms of the councilors? How do you deal with a councilor who may personalize disagreement and take it out of the room with them or what have you, or in what do you try to do with the more junior councilors or the other councilors, just to make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, you're all still friendly at some level?
What I did was during the training sessions, you know, when they first became councilors last year, one of the things that I shared with them is my own experience. I says, what needs to happen here, and you know, I'm city council president, and I'm going to expect civility, and I'm going to expect professionalism, and you don't say anything bad about anybody, you know, unless they're there to, you know, to defend them, but to defend themselves. But one of the most important things that needs to happen is that no matter how somebody votes, everybody votes their conscience. When we leave the dais in Cairo's auditorium, we're all professional and we're all civil. And I have belonged And I have been part of councils in the past where, you know, walking down those stairs, you know, you hear, you know, people just exploding about, you know, about how they voted. That's how, you know, and knock on wood, the new councilors and the old councilors, they get it. They understand that we're out there as professionals, and the public does not want to see us bickering, does not want to see us raising our voices, and does not want to see us being bullies. We are there to listen and to make sound decisions. Sometimes we don't agree with each other, but at the end of the day, we need to be professional, and we know walking out and none of us are, you know, are going to be bosom buddies, but we need to be professional friends, and I think I've achieved that, with the current councilors. I am very proud of them. They have really stepped up to the plate. They work very hard, and just sometimes, you know, when I hear the new councilors, you know, debate their points, and you know, they use the terminology correctly. They understand what's in front of them, which is a big thing. They understand it. And they understand, you know, listening to the proponents and opponents, and have a little passion with it. And they're all very polite. So I'm very, very proud that we had other people come in and train them, but I think I've had a little bit more to get them where they are today. And hopefully it'd be interesting to see how we all make out on the election. But this is one of, in my opinion, this is one of the better councils that we've had in a long, long time.
What are some of the issues the city council is contending with now and will be in the coming months?
Well, the first thing that's coming up is going to be the budget. And there's a couple of things that are happening this year. And one of the things is that the West Parish School starting to pay off the debt service. So in when you're dealing with the business, the finances of the city, whatever revenues come in, the first items that you take off is the debt service, which is the mortgage payments, which are the payments for the interest that are on the all the loans that we've done. So now that we have the debt service starting off, you know, with the West Parish School, that's going to take a chunk of money. So that's a little bit more than we normally have. We're going to have to wrestle with, and the administration is also doing it, is that, there have been COLA raises, there have been contractual raises, and so, as you know, Josh, 85% of the budget is salaries, and so that additional expense. Now, we have to look on the revenue side and see how that all sorts out. If that will increase, you know, we have the committee that has a $2 million shortfall, so that's going to be a big challenge. It's going to be a big challenge for the budget and finance committee, which I am a part of, and it's going to be a challenge for the other councilors, you know, to justify. Maybe we're going to be looking at cutting some of the departments. How we're going to cut, we don't know. But we have to balance our budget, and we have to live within our means. And so we'll see how it all sorts out.
Now,
that's going to be big, very time-consuming, moving that forward.
The school department has been discussing upgrading and their facilities. There's a plan afoot to acquire land, perhaps, to build a new elementary school, much like West Parish, that would house students from East Gloucester and Veterans Memorial. That could be 4 or 5 years out before it happens, but they have to, you know, start the planning process early.
Well, yeah, we're in the queue, and we've gotten accepted. We're going to pay for a study, and which costs a good chunk of change, around $400,000. But we will get reimbursed, you know, on the 60-40 plan. You know, we'll get reimbursed for 60% of that.
Assuming you go and
go and do
and
it,
do
yeah.
Do a facility.
But you know what, Josh? You were part of the school system, and you know that you know, these capital improvement projects, you know, so this is a point in time where you have to bite the bullet. And from where the decision is made until the time the school, that the children actually enter the school, you're talking 10 years. So that's another 10 years laid on these old schools that were built, right after the war, before World War II. It's time, that we have to...
East Gloucester and West Parish schools were sister schools built in 1948 and 1949.
Right.
And the veterans in Beeman were the 54 and 57. So, you know, most of the life cycles... Are 20 to 40 years. You get a boiler, a Cleaver Brooks Brand boiler, it's a 20-year cycle if you take care of it, and it works and all of that. But it
changes the layout of the school and how the school operates in today's standards, where they're not, for one thing, they know the heating and cooling, forget it. They're all sporadic. One room is hot and the other room is cold, you know. And you got areas where there should be media rooms, and there should be cable and Wi-Fi and all that, and it's all missing. It's all patchwork, and it's just something that at some point in time you got to say, this is what we have to do. So
yeah, when they built Gloucester High School, you had the standard was you had to be able to exit a classroom, and go left or right. So you could, if you exited a door, you had to have the capacity to go in the hallway to the left or to the right.
Yep.
You know, 20 years later, it was, you had to have two doors.
Yep.
But the size of the classroom changes. And that's where I think the rub comes, because, you know, the public doesn't always understand all of the details. But the reality, part of it is, the one side of the equation is you go in and spend a lot of money to fix an existing building, but if you go and build a new building, you can't build the same building again because there are so many more new requirements.
Yep. Yeah. That's all true. I'm going to switch phones for you for some of my batteries running low here.
Okay.
Okay, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm going to share with you a little bit of good news.
Okay.
this is the final year we're making a payment on the debt service for Gloucester High School, and of course it's also the final year that we get our check, the reimbursement. But also it's the final year of you're familiar with the CSO.
Yes.
Well, this will be the last summer that the city is going to tear up the streets. You know, when it comes to CSO. So as of this summer, the CSO will be done. And that's been a long haul, as you know.
Combined sewer. Yeah.
You know, that's a combined sewer outfall, to try to get at that all done, and all the digging that we've had to do through all the years and all the expense that we had to do.
Were you surprised that the city administration embarked on a court fight with our neighbors in Essex to render payment? I know that's been carrying along for a few terms now, or a few years at least.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, Josh, that I can't comment on the city's litigation.
That's right. We'll skip to the next question. The administration has reported that their hands have been somewhat tied in terms of staffing the replacement for the police chief. And I have to say, I think John McCarthy, a classmate of mine, is doing a great job. I'm in no hurry to see any changes. But the holdup is the federal government, as I understand it, has told them to go slow until they can wrap up their inquiries into different matters. You know, what level of frustration does that create for either the council or the administration, or both?
It's not as frustrating as it could be, because we have a police chief that's competent, and we're very lucky to have somebody with his experience. If we didn't have John as our police chief.
He's a cop. I mean, he came up through the ranks.
He really came up through the ranks. He, uh, the, The men and women in the police force like him and respect him. So we have a little bit of breathing room, you know, and so having the state and feds, you know, kind of drag their feet or whatever, you know, they're going to do for. But we're very lucky. We have a chief of police that's very competent, and also, so you know, when you know, he runs the department very well. But when it comes to that time, you know, when all these investigations are over with, we're going to do some kind of a
the famed nationwide search.
You know, what exactly would be the improvement, and what would be you know, the best practices for, you know, this time in 2017. You know, we did this a few years ago when we found out that, you know, we needed to have an assistant police chief, which has paid off, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people were grumbling about that, but guess what? It worked out. So let's find out what the best practices are when it comes to policing, and then we can model our police station, our police force, or like that, and then we put out a search for work on the job description for a new chief. So
great.
That's going to take some time, but luckily, you know, John, the chief, has said that he will stay on for as long as he's needed. So
great,
because he's at the point where, you know, he can retire at any time.
Of course he can. Well, thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and wish you best of success leading the city council in Gloucester, and also congratulations on the honor about to be bestowed on you by the Gloucester Rotary Club.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure being on your show, Josh.
Thank you, Joe.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that takes care of it for this morning. Do we have a lineup for next week?
We're working on it. We're waiting for confirmations from a couple of people, but we'll have the next two or three shows booked probably by middle of next week.
All right. Well. Josh Arnold. That's Josh Arnold with Trending Now with Josh, and our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. Have a great weekend.